Hello, I'm ISS Global Head of Research, Georgina Marshall, and welcome to the latest instalment of our 2021 Bulletin podcast series. In this July 21 edition, we'll recap the US and Canada seasons, looking back at key trends, interesting vote results, and some AGM hotspots. Joining me to talk about the season's top trends in the US and Canadian markets are Mark Goldstein, Head of US Research, John Vizikas, Head of Canadian Research, and Kathy Belew, who's a Senior Environmental and Social Specialist in the US Research team. So we're going to kick things off with John today. John, this was the second year in which the pandemic affected proxy season, and of course, and how did Canadian season pan out?
Georgina, while virtual meetings were the standard for 2021, we saw meeting volumes during the traditional proxy season in line with pre-pandemic levels. Unlike in 2020, only few companies postponed their meetings as they were better prepared to hold virtual-only meetings and held their AGMs as traditionally required within 6 months of their fiscal year ends. Preliminary data indicate that year to date, ISS processed over 1,600 Canadian meetings, which is approximately 25% more than during the same 2020 period.
So let me put the same question to you, Mark. How did 2021 differ, if at all, from 2020 in the US market?
Well, as my colleague Rachel discussed on our recent North America Compensation podcast, 2021 was the year when all of the COVID-related adjustments to compensation were actually reflected in proxy disclosures and were the subject of compensation votes. Rachel covered compensation in detail, so I would encourage everyone to listen to that podcast if you haven't already. I'm going to focus today on topics other than compensation. So 2021 was the second year of widespread use of virtual shareholder meetings in the U.S., and this year companies had more time to prepare, as John indicated was the case in Canada, and also more time to learn from last year's mistakes. Anecdotally, it seems that most of this year's virtual meetings went fairly smoothly, but a few companies did seem to go out of their way to make things difficult for shareholder proponents, such as insisting that they submit a pre-recorded statement to be played at the meeting instead of simply providing a live connection for the proponent to join. And although those cases may have been rare, a surprisingly large number of companies held virtual meetings that were audio only with no video component. In a few extreme cases, companies apparently recorded the entire meeting in advance with no opportunity for live Q&A at all. So, although it's certainly possible to have a virtual meeting that largely duplicates the experience of an in-person meeting, companies that are inclined to avoid uncomfortable questions and minimize dissent can take advantage of the virtual meeting format to do that. Of course, this undercuts a major reason why many companies oppose shareholder action by written consent, namely the idea that a meeting provides the opportunity for discussion and debate, whereas written consent does not. And shareholder proponents have seized on that discrepancy. There were 70 shareholder proposals this year, either seeking a right to act by written consent or seeking to lower the hurdles to use an existing written consent right. And in nearly every case, the proponents cited examples of restrictive tactics at virtual meetings as a reason to favor action by written consent. It's not clear how persuasive that particular argument was, but a total of 7 written consent-related shareholder proposals won majority support in the first half of the year, compared to only 3 such proposals in the first half of 2020. Some examples included Xerox, Texas Instruments, and Quest Diagnostics.
Yeah, that's very interesting on written consent proposals. And what about some of the other governance-related shareholder proposals? How did they fare this year?
Well, the numbers on a lot of those proposals were actually down from last year. There were 35 shareholder proposals seeking an independent board chair in the first half of the year, and that's down from 44 last year. None of this year's independent chair proposals passed, although the proposals at J.P. Morgan Chase and Colgate-Palmolive came close. They were each supported by nearly 48% of votes cast. Shareholder proposals related to special meeting rights also declined in number from 39 to 33, while proposals seeking a majority vote standard for director elections dropped from 16 to 12. The number of board declassification proposals also fell slightly from 6 to 5. Although what's most interesting there is that only one of this year's declass proposals was actively opposed by management. All 5 of them won solid majority support. Proposals seeking to eliminate supermajority vote requirements bucked the trend, increasing from 8 last year to 11 this year. All but one of this year's proposals were opposed by management, but all 11 received very strong majorities in favor, which kind of suggests that those boards were not doing a great job of reading the tea leaves. And finally, shareholder proposals seeking to adopt or amend proxy access rights also increased from 13 last year to 28 this year. While none of those proposals received majority support in either year, companies do continue to adopt proxy access bylaws without waiting for a shareholder vote. Close to 80% of companies in the S&P 500 now have proxy access provisions.
And were there any new kind of breakout topics this year for proposals on the governance side?
There weren't any new purely governance breakout topics, but there were a few that straddle the line between governance and environmental and social issues. The first of those is requests for employee representation on boards, which we started to see in 2020 and which continued this year. While these weren't necessarily motivated by the pandemic, the impact of the pandemic on frontline workers may have contributed to a slight increase in average support this year, even though none of these proposals came close to a majority. The other noteworthy new proposal topic is requests for companies to convert to a public benefit corporation. There were 14 such proposals in the first half of the year, mostly at large companies in the financial, industrial, and technology sectors. The proponents argued that large institutional shareholders are universal owners who depend on the health of the economy as a whole and who are harmed if any one of their portfolio companies maximizes its own profit by externalizing the harm from its activities. They argued that the best way to prevent this is for companies to convert to a PBC, explicitly so that they are no longer required to prioritize the interests of shareholders over those of other stakeholders. A year ago, there had been no precedent for an already public company to convert to a PBC. However, both Amalgamated Bank and Viva Systems received approval from their shareholders for such a conversion in 2021. Nevertheless, the companies targeted by these proposals pushed back against the idea that they could only safeguard the interests of stakeholders or build sustainable businesses by fundamentally changing their corporate structure. At the same time, given the wide leeway that public benefit corporations have to define their public benefit, some shareholders may question whether deprioritizing their interests as shareholders is either necessary or sufficient to ensure protection of workers or of the environment. In most cases, these proposals only received support in the 2-3% range.
And while we're talking about issues that straddle the lines between governance and environmental and social issues, of course, the proxy contest at ExxonMobil is a good example of that. Can you talk about that a bit for us?
Sure, that's absolutely a great example. The dissident, Engine Number One, raised concerns about Exxon's ability to successfully navigate the coming energy transition away from fossil fuels, questioning the backgrounds and skill sets of the incumbent directors, in particular, the shortage of energy industry experience and capital allocation expertise on the board. The dissident was also able to take advantage of the frustration many investors felt over the decline in the company's operational performance and capital productivity, and over the board's history of very limited shareholder engagement. In the end, three of the four dissident nominees were elected to the board, and it seems that the dissidents were able to appeal to a broader group of shareholders than would perhaps have been the case if their arguments were limited purely to capital allocation and board composition or purely to climate issues.
And yes, indeed, Mark. And companies are under increasing scrutiny over the diversity of their boards. What's behind that? And what steps have you seen companies taking to perhaps improve board diversity?
Yes, so many investors who initially were largely focused on gender diversity have now turned their attention to racial and ethnic diversity as well, and in some cases are already voting against directors on boards where such diversity is lacking. NASDAQ has proposed a new listing rule which would mandate both gender diversity and the inclusion of members of underrepresented groups, and California already has laws on the books that require board diversity and penalize companies that fail to comply. Although I do have to note that those laws are being challenged and could potentially still be struck down. However, we're already seeing significant progress over the past year, more rapid than in prior years. Among companies in the Russell 3000, 27% now have no racially or ethnically diverse directors, and that's down from 40% last year. 38% of Russell 3000 companies have two or more racially or ethnically diverse directors, compared to 29% a year ago. Among companies in the S&P 500, only 5% still have all white boards, and more than two-thirds have two or more non-white directors.
Thanks for that, Mark. And I'll turn to John in Canada next. In our North America Compensation Focus podcast 2 weeks ago, the team noted that we saw by far the greatest number of Canadian companies with say on pay votes on the agenda, along with an all-time increase in failed say on pay resolutions this year. What does the picture look like now as you recap season?
Yes, as in other markets, the pandemic had a significant impact on compensation. And it appears shareholders scrutinized executive compensation at Canadian companies more so than in previous years. Average support for say-on-pay resolutions dropped from 93.1% in 2020 to 91.6% in 2021. This may not seem like a lot, but if we take a closer look, we see that year-to-date, a total of 6 say-on-pay resolutions failed, and a total of 9 received less than 70% support. This is the highest number of failed say-on-pay resolutions we have ever seen in this market. And to give you an idea of how stark the comparison is with previous years, in 2020, there were no failed say-on-pay votes in the Canadian market, and there were only 3 instances where a say-on-pay resolution received less than 70% support. We also saw a greater number of Canadian companies with say-on-pay resolutions on the agenda. To date, there has been an 8% increase in say-on-pay resolutions compared with last year. And while it appears the adoption of mandatory say-on-pay in Canada may not happen until next year, it seems that more companies have adopted say-on-pay in anticipation of the expected mandate.
Thanks, John. And clearly a lot happening on compensation in Canada this year. And to switch topics and countries again, let me go to Kathy next. Kathy, last year, the majority of all US shareholder proposals submitted were on topics that were related to environmental and social issues. Although, as Mark illustrated, the distinction between E, S and G topics is often not a hard line. Nonetheless, what level and types of E and S related proposals were submitted this year?
Georgina, it was a record-breaking year on several fronts for environmental and social shareholder resolutions in the U.S. This proxy season, we saw a substantial increase in the number of resolutions filed. We tracked nearly 500 ENS-related proposals that were submitted, with one of those being a management proposal. This is an increase from the 445 submitted in 2020's full calendar year. In fact, it's the largest volume of ENS-related resolutions ever filed, according to our tracking. Similarly to last year and the previous 2 years since 2018, ENS-related shareholder proposals comprised a majority of all shareholder proposals submitted in 2021. This year, they made up 60% of all proposals filed, up from 56% and 55% in 2019 and 2020, respectively. After a record amount of 240 or so of these nearly 500 proposals were withdrawn due to settlements, and 75 were omitted due to SEC no action relief, over 180 ENS proposals made it onto ballots, with 4 still pending at companies with late summer and fall meeting dates. The biggest news on the vote result front this season is the significant increase in majority-supported ENS proposals. To date, 35 ENS shareholder proposals and 1 ENS-related management proposal have received majority support from shareholders. And that's up from 21 majority-supported proposals last year and 12 in the year before that, both of which were the previous high watermarks. Also noteworthy is the fact that 8 of the majority supported proposals this year were either supported or at least not opposed by management. And this is much more than previous years and indicates that some companies are beginning to become more aware of and reacting to shareholder sentiment on a number of ENS issues. The long-term trend in rising support levels and majority support for a range of ENS-related resolutions illustrates the shifting views of many investors, including large asset managers. Their voting decisions are increasingly making it clear that they expect portfolio companies to integrate ENS risks and opportunities into their business strategy to be better positioned for long-term sustainable value generation.
And what were the top environmental and social topics of the year coming through in those shareholder proposals, Kathy?
Well, this year, resolutions addressing human capital management concerns topped the list of the number of ENS issue proposals. There were over 130 such proposals filed, and they focused on a variety of issues, such as mandatory arbitration, sexual harassment, gender and racial pay gap, and diversity and inclusion in the workplace, and racial equity. After withdrawals and omissions, just 35 of these proposals made it onto the ballots. Among these, the most prevalent ones were proposals that focused on racial equity. A new type of proposal this year filed at several financial institutions, two pharmaceutical companies, and at Amazon, asked company boards to oversee and conduct a third-party racial justice and/or civil rights audit to evaluate how institutionalized racism may impact their policies and business practices and adversely impact communities of color. Some of the proposals argued, for example, that among other things, banks provided fewer loans to minorities than white applicants and had fewer branches in majority Black communities. The companies generally pushed back, typically stating that they are committed to racial justice and have initiatives in place to minimize disparities based on race and ethnicity. Eight of these proposals went to a vote and received a median support level of over 35%. The ones that received highest support were at JPMorgan Chase and at Amazon, which garnered nearly 48% and over 44%, respectively. While these racial equity proposals did not receive majority support, there were several proposals on the topic of workforce diversity that did. 79 proposals were filed on workforce diversity altogether, significantly up from the 30 last year and the 17 in 2019. 44 of these proposals asked companies to adopt a policy to annually disclose an EEO-1 report, which is an equal employment opportunity report that U.S. businesses above a certain size must fill out, containing employee data such as race, gender, ethnicity, and job category. A majority of these EEO-1 proposals were withdrawn, indicating that most companies agreed to provide this disclosure going forward. While only three proposals ended up going to a vote, two of these, one at DuPont and the other at Union Pacific Corporation, received 83.8% and 86.4% shareholder support, respectively. And both of these were exceptionally high vote results, given that the boards opposed both proposals. The other 35 resolutions related to workforce diversity sought more information on efforts to diversify the company's workforce and/or senior leadership and how they are addressing inclusion. Seven of these proposals went to a vote and four received majority support. These were at American Express, nearly 60%, IBM, just over 94%, Paycom, about 94%, and Union Pacific Corp, just over 81%. I should note the proposals at IBM and Paycom were not opposed by the board.
That is very interesting on the various upticks and results on those human capital related areas, Kathy. And how did climate related and other environmental topics fare this year?
Yes, climate change remains the dominant and high profile environmental issue for many investors. And some shareholders are making the case that climate risk mitigation is a board accountability issue as well. In terms of numbers, climate-related proposals came in second place with 84 proposals filed. After negotiations, a majority of climate change resolutions were withdrawn and several were omitted, leaving just 24 proposals on ballot. Still, a record number of 12 climate change-related proposals received majority support this year. It's also worth noting that compared to last year, the SEC allowed for significantly fewer climate resolutions to be omitted. A large proportion of the resolutions submitted this year focused on carbon asset risk. Primarily, proponents made the case that investors need to better understand and measure the material long-term business risks associated with the low carbon energy transition. The proposals generally ask for more disclosure on greenhouse gas reduction plans aligned with Paris Agreement goals, including for Scope 3 emissions. In several proposals, proponents also referenced a new net zero aim set out by the Climate Action 100 Plus initiative. The net zero company benchmark calls on the world's largest carbon emitters, quote, to work toward reducing GHG emissions to net zero, improving climate governance, and providing specific climate-related financial disclosures, unquote, by 2050. In a win for a proponent called Follow This, a shareholder advocacy group, three proposals asking for GHG reduction targets, including from Scope 3 emissions, received majority support at oil and gas companies Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and Phillips 66, garnering nearly 61%, over 59%, and about 80% of votes cast, respectively. In addition, two other proposals, one at General Electric asking for a report on the progress the company is making to achieving net zero emissions, and the other at Booking Holdings asking for the company to disclose a climate transition plan, received majority support. This year, there was also a record number of climate lobbying proposals that passed. For the second consecutive year, proponents filed proposals at energy companies, oil and gas companies, and airlines asking for a report describing if and how the company's lobbying activities, both direct and through their trade associations, align with the goals of the Paris Agreement. Of the 13 climate lobbying related proposals that were filed, six made it onto ballots, and five of those received majority support at Delta, United Airlines, Norfolk Southern Corporation, ExxonMobil, and at Phillips 66. Last year, just three climate proposals went to a vote, and one at Chevron received majority support. So lastly, on the climate topic, the new type of shareholder proposal that is dubbed Say on Climate, due to its similarity to the Say on Pay resolution, was filed at seven companies this year in the US, asking them to issue a climate transition report and then to provide shareholders with an advisory vote approving or disapproving the plan. Proponents have argued that a Say on Climate vote would enable investors to give companies feedback on their climate plans and would give shareholders information they need to discern if the board is taking adequate steps on climate change risk mitigation. On the other side, some opponents of companies giving a say on climate vote state that the history of Say on Pay shows that it has not been effective in terms of driving corporate change, and that holding directors accountable for poor climate performance would be a more consequential course of action. Some are also concerned that offering the company's climate strategy to approval by shareholders takes the focus of accountability away from directors where it should appropriately reside. One of the Say on Climate proposals that was filed at Moody's Corporation was withdrawn after the company decided to put forward a management proposal providing an advisory vote on its climate plan, the first management proposal of its kind in the US. That proposal passed with 98.8% support. Another one of the proposals filed at S&P Global was supported by the board and ended up receiving 99.5% shareholder support. The others on ballot received 34.6% median support.
And let me bring in John again here, since we did see a number of Say on Climate resolutions from both companies and shareholders in Canada as well. John, how did Say on Climate fare in Canada, and what did you see?
Georgina, Canadian National Railway was the first Canadian company to give its shareholders a Say on Climate vote. The railway company asked its shareholders to approve its climate action plan, and the resolution received over 92% support. CN's competitor, Canadian Pacific Railway, had a shareholder proposal on its agenda requesting that it hold an annual Say on Climate vote. The shareholder proposal was supported by CP and received over 85% shareholder support. The support level was somewhat lower than could usually be expected with a management-supported shareholder proposal. It appears that shareholders remain somewhat mixed on the effectiveness of non-binding Say on Climate votes in driving companies towards carbon neutrality, and thus some may not have supported the shareholder proposal. And while many shareholder proposals were withdrawn and never went to a vote, climate-related proposals also made it on the agenda at Canada's largest banks, and the momentum behind climate appears to gain pace in Canada. At Royal Bank, a shareholder proposal requesting that the bank adopt targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions associated with the bank's underwriting and lending activities and issue an annual report discussing its plans and progress towards achieving these targets received over 31% shareholder support. Last year, a similar shareholder proposal at TD Bank received less than 18% support.
Thanks, John. And as we approach wrapping up, let me just come back to you, Kathy, for my last couple of questions. What about other forms of climate-related shareholder activism in the US this season?
Yes, there was one important one. Majority Action, a nonprofit shareholder advocacy group, conducted a Vote No campaign at companies in sectors which it considers critical in terms of GHG emission levels. The organization urged investors, particularly major asset managers, to vote against certain directors, usually the board chairman or the lead independent director, at 21 companies that it considers are failing to implement plans consistent with limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And of course, as Mark covered earlier at ExxonMobil, three dissident board members were elected and three incumbent directors were displaced after the huge proxy fight with Engine Number One, which had climate transition at its heart. Exxon aside, no board chairman or lead independent director was voted out at the companies targeted by Majority Action.
And lastly, are there any other types of environmental or social proposal trends that are worth mentioning?
Well, yes. In the wake of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, a number of shareholder proponents have stepped up their scrutiny of corporate political contributions and lobbying payments, targeting more transparency regarding political spending, particularly through third-party channels such as trade associations, 527 committees, super PACs, and 501c4 social welfare organizations. They argue that spending through these third parties are unrestricted and largely undisclosed and have played a role in fueling and organizing the Capitol protests. While the number of political spending proposals filed went down from 93 last year to 68 this year, the number of majority supporter proposals on political spending went up from 6 to 9.
And thank you, Kathy, Mark, and John. And that is the end of this North America 2021 season review podcast. Many thanks to our speakers, and even more thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We hope that you found this podcast useful and informative. Please watch your emails over the course of the next couple of weeks for information on and links to the other final episodes of this season's 2021 podcast series. From all of us at ISS, thanks again for joining us, and goodbye for now.